the effort was such that it was like pulling teeth, really, because I would ask, so how would you describe what you do? And I will get things like, oh, we advance a positive agenda. What? Your profession? Seriously? So we know what teachers do, we know what doctors do, but you advance a positive agenda, really. So you tell that to a kid, and what do they think? And my determination was to be very specific, not just write a book in the abstract or a theoretical thing on academic board. I wanted real-life people and stories and see, when you talk about what American diplomacy does, what does that mean in real life? How does it affect me? And so with this in mind, I went around, as Andrew said, to 52 embassies and consulates on every continent but Antarctica, because there isn't anything there, and interviewed these people that Andrew already mentioned. So I would like to introduce you to four American diplomats, just to give you a brief idea of some of the things they've done in their careers, just to show you, and those of you in the Foreign Service know better than me, but just to show how diverse these duties in the Foreign Service have become. So this is Cameron Munter. He wanted to be here tonight, but I don't see him, so I hope apparently he's not back from New York. But in any case, he was the American ambassador to Pakistan the last 2 years. He just retired literally a week ago from the Foreign Service. He was one of the very few people who watched the raid that killed bin Laden. He was in Islamabad, and so one of the video feeds was actually at the embassy in Pakistan. It fell on him and his team at the embassy to explain to the Pakistanis why on earth they had no idea about a foreign military operation on their territory. But that was nothing compared to the next task. And the next more serious task was to repair the relationship. The bin Laden raid came a few months after a CIA contractor had shot two Pakistanis and killed them. And a few months after the bin Laden raid, of course, the NATO strike that inadvertently killed 24 Pakistani soldiers took place. So there's no way to overestimate how difficult this job was. But before he went to Pakistan, Cameron was the leader of a PRT, a provincial reconstruction team in Iraq, in Mosul. And he and his team taught the Iraqis how to build a judicial system, how to govern effectively, because obviously, until then, governance in Iraq was not quite existent. And in fact, between those two assignments, Iraq and Pakistan, he was the ambassador to Serbia. In 2008, he was the ambassador when a few hundred Serbs set part of the embassy on fire after the United States recognized Kosovo as an independent state. And then he got evidence that the person who'd approved the attack was the prime minister of Serbia. And he then decided to do everything in his power to make sure that guy didn't get reelected. And he did. How he did it, you can read in the book. The second of the four diplomats is Yuri Kim. Yuri is currently the political counselor in Ankara, in Turkey, and she spent most of the past year working with the Turks to get Bashar al-Assad to stop killing his people in Syria. Clearly not very successfully, but that's another story. Before she went to Iraq, in fact, at the time Munter was dealing with the embassy on fire in Belgrade, Yuri Kim was in North Korea. She accompanied the New York Philharmonic during that concert tour they had in North Korea. And in fact, she had negotiated it. She was at the time the assistant to Chris Hill, the negotiator with North Korea, but because Chris was too high profile, he sent her to negotiate the concert visit with the New York Philharmonic. The third of the four diplomats is David Lindwall, who just returned from Iraq, where he was the political military counselor of the embassy. His main job was selling American weapons to the Iraqi government. Before that, he was the deputy chief of mission in Haiti, and he managed the search for missing Americans after the earthquake in 2010. His house collapsed, and he's alive today only because he wasn't home. But a colleague of his, the cultural affairs officer, Victoria DeLong, died because she was home and her house collapsed. Before that, he was the DCM in Guatemala. And he and his team helped reform the Guatemalan child adoption system. Did you know that American diplomats reform child adoption systems? Why do we care? Because it turns out many Americans adopt children from Guatemala. Guatemala, in fact, is number 3 on the list, only after Russia and China, of the number of adopted children by American parents. And apparently the system was so corrupt that Americans were spending thousands upon thousands of dollars on bribes. It's changed. It's no longer that way. And in fact, if we think that reforming a child adoption system is complex, how about what the embassy in Santiago did a few years ago? They actually helped reform the judicial system, because until Pinochet was out of power, Chile didn't have trials on first instance, only trials on appeal. The embassy in Chile actually brought down architects from the U.S. to teach the Chileans how to build courthouses, because the Chileans didn't know how. They never had big enough courthouses for trials. And everybody, including the Chilean media, declared the effort a huge success and gave the U.S. huge credit, which doesn't happen very often these days. And the last of the Foreign Service officers is Gavin Sandoval, whose first time in a Panamanian jail was actually during his first tour in the Foreign Service, 1998. He went to visit 2 satanist killers because they were American citizens. And he was there to make sure they were treated humanely and according to all the international standards. He just came back from Afghanistan, where he was the press attaché. And you remember a few months ago when that American soldier went and killed 16 Afghans in cold blood. And before that, when American soldiers burned the Korans. Well, this guy had to put out those fires. And of course, as many of you know, every day of the year, American embassies promote American business, whether it's opening new markets to companies, expanding markets, lowering or eliminating tariffs and other duties. So let's review quickly the duties that I just mentioned, and this is a very short list. So we have teaching effective governance, mantra in Iraq, nuclear negotiations, cultural events, reforming child adoption systems, selling American weapons, recovering from natural disasters, promoting American business, issuing passports and visas, which of course the consular officers do, visiting prisoners in jail, fixing public relations problems. How can all this be part of the same profession? How can someone do these things, even 2 of these things, equally well? And you might say, well, they don't have to do everything. Well, actually, they do. Because when you come into the Foreign Service, you're called the generalist. And you are expected, whatever cone you are, whatever career track you have, you are expected to do everything. Because you never know what will happen in the country you're serving in. And by the way, if you are a public diplomacy officer, you might have to do a political or economic job because that post is better for your family. And so, looking at this and making sense of it, I wanted to go back to why are these people there at those embassies? Can they do some of these things by sitting in Washington? Do they have to be there? What is the big picture? And I must tell you that when I began with this project, one of the things that did surprise me was when I would ask people around various embassies and consulates how what they did fit into the big picture of American foreign policy, they couldn't tell me. They had enough to do. That wasn't the issue. The issue was the big picture. And granted, at the time, the time was sort of weird because it was right after the Iraq War began. The Foreign Service had the job of selling policies that were popular in a lot of the world. So the perception was also that that White House in the first Bush term didn't value diplomacy as much as perhaps it should have or it did in the second term. And you might remember that many people were talking at the time about the militarization of foreign policy. So the Foreign Service didn't feel comfortably enough, I thought. And that's how I explained partly why it was difficult for many people to put their daily activities into the big picture of American foreign policy. But I wanted to go back to the national interest, because that's ultimately what the Foreign Service is doing this, right? That's why they're there. That's why they're spending a taxpayer's money, and we'll see how much they're spending. But the point is, we're not out there just because we want to be nice to people. this perception of, oh, he's a diplomat, he must be nice and tactful and polite. That's not what a diplomat really is. So I looked up the national security strategy. And this is what this president expects of the Foreign Service. Our diplomacy and development capabilities must help prevent conflict, spur economic growth, strengthen weak and failing states, lift people out of poverty, combat climate change and epidemic disease, strengthen institutions of democratic governance. Oh my God. How ambitious or more ambitious can this get? How do you do that? How much money and people do you need to do that? And as I went around the country in the past 2 weeks, people don't know this. People don't know that this is what the Foreign Service is expected to do. Okay, so let's deconstruct this. What is the national interest? There's actually agreement on this in both parties, surprisingly. The national security strategy of Obama is not too different from the second Bush strategy. And the national interest consists of three components: security, prosperity, values. And the White House has determined, as had the previous White House, that for the United States to be truly secure, the entire world must be truly secure and stable. Because it's not difficult for a regional conflict to spill over and affect other countries and eventually entire continents. Transnational crime and all that. The second is prosperity, same logic. They have determined, whether you like it or not, whether you agree with it or not, both of the last administrations have determined that for the United States to be truly prosperous, as much of the world must be prosperous as possible. Now, this is not something that we'll see in our lifetime, but the point is to have countries with functional economies that have some economic growth. This has been difficult in the last few years because it's not easy for American diplomats to preach this given the situation at home. But that's why they get the big bucks, right? Okay, so based on this, what is the Foreign Service's mission? So we want a world that is stable and secure and prosperous, but that's a world that we don't have yet. That's what we want to get. Or the White House says, this is the world we seek. Condi Rice used to call it transformational diplomacy. And there was a bit of, I thought, misunderstanding of this phrase because people thought we were trying to change other countries in the U.S. image. This was never about that. This was about good governance. We wanted representative, responsible, and accountable governments, which means what? Governments provide basic services to their people, respect their rights, and also provide economic opportunities so they have jobs instead of going and becoming terrorists and blowing themselves up. So this is half of the mission of the Foreign Service, to bring about that world, clearly very grand, very ambitious, almost impossible. The first is the White House also recognizes the world as it is. We can't ignore it. We have to deal with it. And that's what traditional diplomacy does. We all know that. That's why we think the embassies are there, to manage relations and to make sure everything is peaceful, right? So this is the dual mission of the Foreign Service. It deals with the world as it is and tries to bring about a world that is more secure and prosperous so the United States can be secure and prosperous. And within that traditional diplomacy category, of course, this is most of you, I'm sure, know this, but there are four functions, four core functions: managing foreign relations, representing the United States and its people abroad, assisting American citizens, and addressing transnational issues, which is what we call multilateral diplomacy, managed by the UN, NATO, EU, these international organizations. And then we get to that second point of transformational diplomacy, or whatever you call it. Hillary Clinton hasn't been using this term. But essentially what she's saying is very close to this. As I said, it goes back to good governance. How do we make sure that more and more of the world, more countries in the world, actually have governments that practice effective governance? So, to do all this, what does the Foreign Service have? 2011, $53 billion. More than any other time in history. 13,000 members, 8,000 Foreign Service officers, so diplomats, that's the official name, as many of you know, Foreign Service officer, and then 5,000 Foreign Service specialists. And these are the information management people. Sean Smith, who died in Libya, was one of them. And secretaries, as well as diplomatic security. They're also specialists. So let's compare that to the armed forces. This was more than 600. It was about 640 billion in terms of the budget. And 1.4 million active members of the military. This number does not include the civilian personnel working at the Pentagon. I'm not saying they should be equal. I'm just showing you the facts. There's been debate, obviously, during the campaign about defense cuts and so forth and the Navy and ships and all that. But that's not my business. So the last couple of things I wanted to mention before we go to Q&A. I was very careful not to glamorize the Foreign Service, not to denigrate the Foreign Service, not to judge the Foreign Service too much, but just to tell the story. What it does, why does it, how does it link to the national interest, why should we care, how does it affect our lives? And my other surprise doing this has been the depth of engagement the United States has in every single country in the world. I thought I knew, but I didn't know enough. Because American diplomats are literally weaved into people's lives. And that work of American diplomacy affects not only people in other countries, it affects people in the United States as well. Think about an American company that works in Nigeria, for example, or in anywhere in Africa. Something happens in Nigeria, instability or a strike or a natural disaster, well, then that affects that American company's bottom line, and that has an impact on things here at home. And if that, the bigger the company, the bigger the impact. So I wanted not only to link what the Foreign Service does and why it does it to the national interest, but also humanize it and demystify the profession. Because I found so many people think that anyone can do diplomacy. And I sort of understand it, but not really. Because why don't we let anyone who doesn't have training as a doctor perform an operation? Why don't we let anyone build bridges who doesn't know how to build bridges? But why do people think that anyone can do diplomacy? Well, they do. That's why we have political ambassadors 30% every time, right? Well, because people think diplomacy is easy. Oh, what? He can run an embassy. Of course he can. He ran a company. Of course he can run an embassy. By the way, there are very good political ambassadors. That's not the point. There are political ambassadors who put to shame Korea ambassadors. But again, they're also bad political ambassadors. So this humanizing thing that I tried to do, I found that there are actually three aspects of the humanizing of American diplomacy that I found has taken place in the last decade. And the first concerns the Foreign Service itself. I was doing a radio interview this morning, and the host said, well, the Foreign Service is so elite. Actually, not really anymore. I mean, all you need to do is be between 21 and 59 and be an American citizen and pass a test. You don't need to have a college degree. So that's part of it. The Foreign Service actually has become more open. Doesn't mean that the test is easy. It's not. And people come after the second or the third time. But the Foreign Service today looks more and more like America. We have here at least two people from the A100 class that I sat on some of their classes in January. They had people of all colors and ages and professional backgrounds. It was truly, truly diverse. We're not there yet. The Foreign Service is still 80% white, with 5% black, 7% Asian. So there's a long way to go. But if you look at these younger classes coming in and the people who've come in the past 4 or 5 years, you'll see true diversity. And it takes time, of course, to reach the senior ranks of the Foreign Service. The second part of this humanizing is to other countries. What I mean by that is American diplomats are really trying hard to open up to foreign publics. And thanks to a large part to Hillary Clinton, because she's been emphasizing this people-to-people diplomacy, right? So the point there is that government-to-government doesn't do the entire job anymore. Because of social media, instant communication, 24/7 news cycle, globalization, even in countries that are not democracies, public opinion matters. And so now they've decided, the Foreign Service or the State Department, that they should be reaching directly foreign publics over the heads of the government. In fact, I have a story in the book about 75 African young leaders, they call them, who were here about a year or so ago. They met with Michelle Obama and others. They went back, and guess what? They were called in by the foreign ministry and asked, why? How did you get to meet Michelle Obama? And our foreign minister doesn't get any time with her. Right? So they're trying. Again, this is baby steps. This is the beginning. The last part of this is particularly baby steps, and that's opening up to the American public, to educate the American public about what the Foreign Service does, and also to find ways for Americans to contribute to American diplomacy, whether it's through the private sector and companies, whether it's Amazon or McKinsey, whoever it is, but also to find ways to private Americans to do it. Now, one thing I will say that I found troubling, and I don't use this word very often, it's really astonishing to me how bad the State Department is at explaining what it does, including on the Hill. A few months ago, there was a sub-program in what's called the Middle East Partnership Initiative, and the state wanted money to continue for the new fiscal year, and both on the relevant committee, both the Republican and Democratic ranking member said no, not even a cent. Not only are we not increasing it, we're not going to give you a cent. And they said because you couldn't explain to us how the money will be used. I found that very prevalent in the Foreign Service. I actually quote, I believe, a program or a press release that says specifically we'll do this and this, and they have the bullet points, and I read this, and this is specific? I'm sorry, it may be specific to the State Department, it's not specific to me. This is very vague. And so, as Hillary Clinton told me, she believes that the better informed about what the Foreign Service does, members of Congress are, the more resources there'll be for diplomacy. But it's not only incumbent upon the members of Congress to know. State has to explain. And unfortunately, historically, it has not been good at that. I'm not saying that what they're doing is not meaningful or important or essential. I'm just saying perhaps they need help articulating what they do and perhaps thinking about what they do more strategically. And this is my last point. And here is another thing that I discovered which surprised me. Turns out nobody in Washington has sat down to think what kind of foreign service the United States needs in 5 years or 10 years. Seems that they're just improvising. Is this good or bad? I'm not giving the answer. I'm just saying that's what it is. Some argue that that's how they do it. That's what diplomacy is. You just figure things out. That's why until Colin Powell came along, there was no training in the Foreign Service, really. You just came in, and then you were, as many people in the book said, you were basically thrown in a pool and you have to learn how to swim. But to me, if you don't know what kind of foreign service you want to have in 5 or 10 years, how do you know what kind of skills you're looking for? How do you know what kind of people then you recruit and test to bring in? And ultimately, ultimately how you train those people? To me, these are questions that need an answer, because when something like Libya happens, then you need to have your best people in the right places. And it seems to me, as I've been told by many people in the Foreign Service, right now, luck in the Foreign Service is key, because it really matters who you work for and what you work on. And your career depends so much on this. And as a junior officer, if you happen to have a great boss, you're golden. But if you come across someone who is not a good boss, then your career might be over before you know it. So I will end with this, what I call identity crisis, which I found after 9/11, the Foreign Service thought about these duties that I described earlier and said, wait a second, we came in expecting to do certain things, and now we're being asked to do more and more things. Go and do the staff the embassy in Baghdad, then go out in the provinces and teach these people how to govern. We didn't sign up for this. They didn't say they wouldn't do it. They just said, wait a second, we don't know how to do this, and we are getting 2 weeks of training before we go to Iraq. No language. They teach us how to shoot for a day and a half in West Virginia, but we don't even carry weapons, right? So there was this thing about, again, being thrown without being prepared. And it was, as one officer in the book says, it was a shock to the system. It, not because we are not ready to do these things. It's because we just weren't prepared. Not only does the American public have this perception of what diplomacy is, but we, as Foreign Service officers, came into the service with a perception of what diplomacy is, or it should be, and suddenly it turns out it's quite different, unless, of course, you're serving in Vienna or Geneva, but that's another story. So I'm trying to start this program, which ultimately my ambition is to lead to what would be called the Center on the Practice of Diplomacy, which will carry on what I've tried to do with the book, demystify diplomacy as a profession, explain and articulate diplomacy to the American public and members of Congress, and hopefully start the public debate about what kind of diplomacy the United States needs, what kind of foreign service it needs. Because the Foreign Service today operates on the basis of the Foreign Service Act of 1980. That's before Ronald Reagan. Maybe it's time to think about this and see whether we need different kinds of bases that the Foreign Service and American diplomacy can operate on so we don't get things like politicizing during a presidential campaign and being accused of things that perhaps American diplomacy doesn't do, which is American diplomacy doesn't spy. There are other agencies who do spying, but the Foreign Service doesn't spy. I'm always asked about this. So I will end on that, and I will not answer questions about spying, but I'll answer any other questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, I see hands in the air already, so we'll go straight to questions. Please just wait for a microphone, and then if you could identify yourself for Nick, that would be great. Let's go right here, George.
Sure, hi. George Nicholson from StratCorp. When you were doing your research, did you look at the last Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review? The intent of that was supposed to mirror the Department of Defense, QDR, of what the future looks like. Again, did you look at that, and did that address any of your concerns?
Of course, it's quoted throughout the book. There are specific quotes from that QDR. I thought it was actually a very good document as far as government documents go. I'm very helpful. It forced the State Department to think more strategically. But as one Foreign Service officer told me, strategic thinking in the Foreign Service is beaten out of you. There really seems right now that strategic thinking is not encouraged in the Foreign Service. The mantra is we're more operational now. Right? We want to go and get things done, make things happen. So the QDDR, I thought, went quite far in forcing the institution to think about these questions, but you'll see many of them on paper, many of the things that it recommended or said that would happen, and I'm afraid they won't happen before Hillary Clinton leaves. So for me, the question is, will the next Secretary of State carry on what the QDDR did? And the answer is to be, yes, David.
David Jones. I formerly worked with Nick at the Washington Times. I'm now with Voice of America, and having gone from private sector journalism to working in the government, I can appreciate the remark on having enterprise and so forth beaten out of them. But I wanted to ask you, Nick, in light of the recent events in Benghazi, were not only a personal tragedy for the individuals, but also have become a political liability for the administration, and no doubt creating even more pressure for diplomats around the world to retreat inside the high walls of their bunkers and so forth. How do you see this affecting this desire to reach out and become do more public diplomacy, get out and meet people in the countries, and is this going to be a setback?
books. People were leaving and trying to buy books, and we ran out of books. But if there are people who would like to buy the book, you can actually buy the book tonight back in the back with Dan, and then we will send you a copy in the morning if you give us your address. And there's no delivery charge of any kind. So we'll just honor the price that everybody else paid for the book, and we'll send you a special copy in the mail. But to the question, inevitably when something like this happens for reasons that have to do with politics and others, you do tighten security because you want to make sure this doesn't happen again. Hillary Clinton actually had made a significant effort to balance the need for security and being out there and interacting with foreign publics. And in fact, there is language to that effect in the QDDR. There were many issues, not with just with the buildings, but in every country, members of the embassy have these rules that say you can't go outside the capital this many miles radius, or you can't go to this part of the country without security protection or things like that. I think she has, 3 months left? Her determination is to have the public diplomacy staff particularly to go about their business and reach out to foreign publics. But that's, of course, politically not winning in an election year. And so I think what will happen is they will try not to talk about it. I think it's just an issue that rather not be discussed.
Okay, in the middle.
Yes, sir, right here.
Thank you very much. I'm a retired FSO, and I also teach diplomacy at New York University. Your contribution is very helpful. I was taken by your point about focus groups in Arkansas, talking with them about what they may know about the Foreign Service. And I was curious for how would the Department of State get through to more Americans about the Foreign Service, the good work that is done every day at every mission around the world, and the hard work? And how would you suggest that this occur? I might also add that in the academic side, that in political science departments, generally speaking, diplomacy is not highly regarded simply because it doesn't seem to lend itself as well to the scientific hypotheses of other political, other social sciences. But there are some theorists out there, which is rather interesting too. And that sort of is another point, is how can you get Americans to think more about diplomatic solutions rather than military solutions to foreign policy problems? Thank you.
By writing a book about it, I suppose. But on the State Department front, the State Department has what's called diplomats in residence, as I'm sure you know. They're not enough, if you ask me, but the issue with them, I find, is again that the abstract way of explaining things. They are there to recruit. They're based at universities. I think, honestly, it's about telling stories. You have to humanize it. You can't just say, oh, he's had an extraordinary career. What does that mean? It's a fascinating profession. Okay, and then it stops at that. You meet someone on the plane. What do you do? I'm a diplomat. Oh, it must be fascinating. And that's where it stops, right? Because it's just either not interesting enough. I mean, as Colin Powell says in the book, we all know what soldiers do. They fight or get ready to fight. What do diplomats do? They talk. Well, how exciting is that? Right? So by nature, unless you deep down, you know, dig deep down and you get to that human side of it and the stories. And I have a story in the book about how the United States, all our money, did you know that we helped rice farmers in Nigeria increase their revenue by 400%? Do you know that? They were living on $2 a day before that program, it's called Markets, came along. I had no idea about this. I mean, these are specific things. This is not nuclear negotiations, some abstract thing that, I mean, not the nuclear negotiations is abstract, but it, most people don't relate to that. But you relate to farmers. You relate to American business because there are jobs on the line and unemployment is not in a very good place right now. So find a way to tell stories. And since you asked this question, I don't know when I'll get around to doing it, but I've been thinking about writing a pilot for a TV show on the Foreign Service. It'll be the State Department version of the West Wing. Sharon Stone will be the Secretary of State. She was one of the people I interviewed for the Financial Times years ago, so she, God knows, she needs work. So, but anyway, all right, yes, in the middle.
Hi, good evening. I'm John Mitchell. I'm a graduate student at George Washington, and I'm also an active duty lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. Four tours in Iraq. I applaud your efforts with this novel. I've read a preview on via Google, and it's very good. I bought the book today. Looking forward to reading it. Military officers not only break things, and we're Neanderthals, but we also do, you know, stuff like active engagement. And I think this is kind of where the crisis that we experienced because of this movie, The Innocence of Islam, may have fallen a little bit short. And I think we need to add possibly another core competency to an FSO's duty description, which is crisis communication. We were able to avoid, and I was in Iraq at the time, Pastor Jones was threatening to burn a few, you know, Korans. And so we did some active engagement in Iraq when he was threatening to do this so that to, you know, circumvent any potential problems with our partners, our, you know, tribal leaders, governmental leaders, Iraqi military leaders, so that they understood that this is not the feeling of the United States military or you know, American leadership in general. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on active engagement and how this could have averted the worldwide crisis as a result of this movie on YouTube.
The issue of engagement is big right now, as you know, with the campaign. And apparently there are these factions in the Republican Party, the, you know, the engagement proponents and the ones who are not so crazy about engagement. But I've heard Romney talk about engagement, right? Leading. He wants to lead from the front, right? So to me, really, when I went around, and it's important not only to educate Americans about what the Foreign Service does and why it's important, but it's also, for me, important to educate publics in other countries. Because I know that the Middle East expert will say, this is not about misunderstanding. Okay, fine, but it's not only about the Middle East. In many countries, I find that people just have these perceptions about American diplomacy and what American diplomats do that has to do with spying. And that's why I'm going to Geneva tomorrow, and then Amman and London and Tokyo and so on, and hopefully countries where this is even more helpful. But to explain to people that clearly what the Foreign Service does has to serve American national security. There is no way around it. Otherwise, it's just silly not to do that. These resources, human and financial, are spent to protect the security and prosperity of the United States. But it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. In other words, in order for the U.S. to be well, that doesn't mean that other countries have to not be well, right? But that's what people think in other countries. It must be, go to Russia. I mean, particularly the old school people, the Putin's generation. They're still back in the Cold War, and they think, if it's good for the Americans, it must be bad for us. Well, no, we would like for Uganda or Ghana or Cambodia to have effective governance, to have accountable governments, because not only will that be better for life of people in those countries, but it will be ultimately better for us because of that argument that I talked about earlier with the linkage to security and prosperity. So I'll try my best, as with the very little resources I have, but obviously that wouldn't be enough. But I think the state can do more on this. These embassies there with all these cultural and public affairs sections, I think they can do more if they were to think strategically. Yes.
Thank you. Hi. My name is Ashley Donahue. I actually currently work for the U.S. Department of State. And my question actually relates to the relationship between not just the Foreign Service, but the Civil Service as well. As I'm sure you know, the Civil Service is almost of the same size as the Foreign Service, as part of the same department working on the same mission, but under two completely systems that you may also have noticed don't always work that well together. And I wondered if you had looked into the relationship the Civil Service and Foreign Service has and how that relationship might change in the coming century.
There is a chapter about this in the book. It was probably one of the more difficult chapters to write because it's so... the feelings are just so strong on both sides. People get very emotional, and I don't think... Now, the civil service... Well, actually, neither side thinks the system is working. The civil service is about 10,000, so the foreign service is more about 3,000. But I don't see things changing anytime soon. Here's the thing about sweeping reforms in the State Department. And going back to that 1980 Foreign Service Act. The Secretary of State job is actually three jobs in one, right? The other cabinet secretaries in town are the CEO of the department. The Secretary of State is the CEO of her department. She's also the chief diplomat of the country, which makes her the COO in a way. And she's also the president's foreign policy advisor, chief foreign policy advisor. So that's about three jobs in one. I'm saying this because when you look at reforming the Foreign Service or the State Department, there's no Secretary of State who comes into office and knows that they'll be there for more than 4 years. That doesn't happen. That's right. I mean, George Shultz also had about seven. But typically, you don't know whether your president will get reelected. And even in Clinton's case, she won't stay even if Obama gets reelected. So imagine you have 4 years, and you have to be the CEO of the building, the chief American diplomat, and the president's chief foreign policy advisor. Would you go and try to reform the Foreign Service? Seriously, would you? So it has to be someone that has nothing to prove, that doesn't care what people think, meaning how well, you know, how many countries they visit and how many miles they fly, and someone who is not afraid of starting this and not finishing it and passing it on to someone else. In other words, not worrying about the credit they might get. Show me that person and I'll shut up. I think there was someone over there. In the
back row.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, the lady...
Thank you. My name is Terry Murphy. I'm a senior associate at CSIS. I'm also a recovering lawyer and spent a lot of time in and out of lots of foreign ministries and foreign services throughout a long international career. Earlier this year, I was given an award by the Commerce Department, the first ever to a private citizen, not for furthering the exports to our country, but for furthering, and I quote, the foreign policy and national security interests of the United States over the 8 presidential terms since 1982. That's my creds. I would say in furtherance of your book here, you've got a nice piece on the Foreign Commercial Service. There is a very large piece of American foreign policy that is not at all at the State Department. It's at the USIA, it's in which is somewhere, I'm not sure where they are these days, public diplomacy. It's at the Commerce Department. It is in the business community, in the NGOs. And I promise you they use exactly the same techniques, the non-papers, the quiet conferences, the whispering in the hallway. They do everything, and they work very, very, very closely with our government. And I have to say, I think the State Department is a lovely place. I'm the guy who took all your trouble because I bought 8 books. I took them out for all my friends who are in the State Department and many, many other agencies. I won't tell you what they are, who've served this country. So hurrah for you. But I do suggest that you broaden your pitch. The State Department is not the only game in town. Not by any means the only game in town.
Right, which is why I included the Foreign Commercial Service and the Foreign Agricultural Service and USAID, of course.
Right.
But this is a book about the Foreign Service. So
right.
Hopefully the other people will write about the other agencies. They need to broaden their perspective.
And right. Lots of other
right.
perspectives.
Yes, because, of course, American foreign the foreign policy turf has been claimed by literally every department in town. So
right.
That's why it's so difficult for the State Department now, because you've got every other part of the government. It's so easy to travel, right? You get on a plane and you're in Beijing in 12 and 13 hours. So.
Okay, well, thank you.
The lady before with the glasses, I think, had her
and that'll be
up,
the
yeah.
And that'll be the last question.
Hi, my name is Kristen Smith. I'm a Rangel Fellow at Department of State and a grad student at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. And I'm just wondering, you mentioned that there are competing views about Foreign Service officers. Some think that they're very elite. Some think that anyone can do that job. And I'm wondering, looking at the current testing structure and the current training structure, do you think that we're getting the best people for the job? And what would you do to improve or change that process?
Do you have 7 hours? Well, there's a whole chapter called Teaching Diplomacy in the book, because that's a very, very serious question. The State Department says that they have designed a process, an entrance process, through the written test, the oral test, that brings in the best pool of people, the most diverse people with various skills in case they need to rely on these skills. They've hired, professional psychologists? Not professional, industrial psychologists, right? Industrial psychologists, and they, you know, have paid all these consultants tons of money to tell them that. Is there a way to know? What I found, or what was the biggest criticism within the service, was the oral exam, meaning people weren't sure, and if any of the people here has served on a panel of examiners on the oral exam. This is not, I haven't taken the test myself, so I don't know this, but what I've been told is that people weren't sure whether the officers, active or retired, who examine you at the orals are the best people to do that. Meaning many of them are retired, as I said, or towards the end of their career. It's very subjective. Whether you pass or not is very, very subjective. It's on these people. It's the guidelines are not very specific. And so you're dependent on them to first define what a good diplomat should be in 2012. And then from all you offer, whether it's your experience, your language skills, your conversational skills, your persuasive skills, they have to determine that. It's not an easy job. But how do you know? How do you know that you accepted someone not that good and you rejected someone who was better? It's very difficult, right? It's like when I was asking people about how do you measure the results of diplomacy? And that's why actually you mentioned the Foreign Commercial Service, the what I call economic and business diplomacy. That's one part of diplomacy where you see the results pretty quickly, right? Because you know that the tariff has been lowered by Japan or whatever country. You know that the revenue of that company has expanded. But in classic diplomacy, how do you know that your efforts didn't help prevent an attack on Seattle? Right? So it's a similar thing when it comes to bringing people into the service. How do you know that you missed out on someone good? Or someone that you thought was brilliant couldn't even get tenure, because everybody has to get tenure before they move on and get promoted. You just don't. And so there are risks. To me, the biggest question is back to going to the, you know, what kind of foreign service do we want? What kind of skills do we need in 2012? And if we can find the people who we think have the good foundation and then train them. You know, I mean, ask the people who are coming in today. They're not getting much of training. I mean, the A100 is on orientation. It's not training. I have people in the book who, you know, who took they teach cable writing, for example, at FSI. And then people go to posts and they say, oh my God, this has nothing to do with real life. I mean, what we asked to do here has nothing to do with what we were taught at FSI. I find part of the reason is because some of the people who teach at FSI haven't actually done it in 25 years. I was on a class, sitting on a class where the person who was teaching the class hadn't practiced what she was teaching since 1985. I'm sorry, things have changed. So, oops. All right.
Well, Nick, it was a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for coming. We'll have to host you to screen your pilot when you get around to when you get around to writing it. Please all join me in thanking Nick.
Thank you.